All right, just center yourself. All of us have been doing a lot. This time of year is particularly busy. A happy busy, but nonetheless, busy, busy. So now that we're here, the more we let go of everything else, the more likely we are to find in this experience what we're seeking. Centering yourself in the breath is a very simple way to bring your consciousness into the now. Just concentrate on the breath flowing in and flowing out. Just simply observe and experience yourself breathing. Lift your eyes slightly above the horizon line, your closed eyes, as if you were looking out at a beautiful expansive view through a window that's just a little above your eye level. And out through that window, you're gazing out through that window toward a great expanse of open ocean, open sky. Feeling yourself in the moment, simply breathing in and breathing out. As your consciousness expands out through that slightly raised window to that great expanse of ocean and sky. Om peace. Okay, great souls, here we are. Our topic tonight is freedom, which is a really fun topic. They sort of make these up for me, but they're very clever, and I like them. Some of you I know are here just because I'm teaching, so because you are my good friends and you like to come and make me feel happy to see you, and I appreciate that. If anyone else has a particular reason for being here, particular interest in this subject, I wouldn't mind hearing that before we begin. Does anyone have a contribution to make before I take over for a long time? Questions or thoughts? Why you came tonight? Okay, then you're at my mercy. You can't say I didn't warn you or give you a chance. This is a very interesting topic, freedom, because it's not necessarily what people think about. And one of the things that makes it so confusing is that we don't necessarily have a unified idea of what we mean by this word. When I was growing up, I was a pretty good girl, except for a little period around, 12, 13 years old when my mother thought I got under the influence of bad companions. But I was the bad companion, actually, but we never really got that straightened out in that past. And most of my life, I've lived in a fairly harmonious way, and I get along with people, and I haven't had a lot of troubles. But when I was about 18 years old, 19. I began to realize, I began to study spiritual teaching. I should give you, because some of you I've never met before, so let me give you a context. When I was 22 years old, which was 1969, at Stanford University, Swami Kriyananda, whose picture is not out here right now, Swami Kriyananda, who is a direct disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda, Yogananda came to America in 1920 from India. He lived in Los Angeles until 1952. This book, if you haven't read it, is really one of the all-time classics of our age and probably for centuries to come. Almost everyone who does any kind of spiritual seeking in any non-traditional way comes to this book. Almost any setting you're in, you ask people who's read it, and almost everyone has. If you have read the orange version of this book, read this one. This is the first edition of the book. The orange book is the 13th edition. Almost all the editing that has caused that book to be reissued was done after Yogananda died. And I don't approve. This is much better. So even if you've read it, buy this one, read it again, throw away the orange one. Don't give it away, throw it away. Okay. little dig there, but nonetheless, this is the original. Yogananda had many disciples. Included among them is an American man named Donald Walters, who's far better known as Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda was raised in Europe, but his parents are American. He came to America when he was in his early teens. He really has lived and lives all over the world. And he founded the temple and community of which I am a part, which is called Ananda. And Ananda is a series, a network of communities, 8, almost 9 in the world, 1 in Europe, 2 forming in India, and the rest in the United States. And and Swami Kriyananda is my link through whom I've come to know Yogananda's teachings. Coming back now, when I was 22 years old, I lived in Palo Alto area, and Swami Kriyananda was invited to speak at Stanford University, not by the university, but by one of the fraternities there. And they had a tent in the backyard of the Beta Chi house, and Swami Kriyananda came and spoke. It was a kind of a loony atmosphere, and just a little, it was like a party atmosphere, but there he was. It's a very strange night, but it was the first time that I met him. And I was already studying self-realization, the principles of self-realization through the path of Ramakrishna and Vivekananda. But I was absolutely bewildered as to how to take these magnificent ideas, which I was so enamored of, and actually have my life look different. Because even though I felt like my thoughts were transforming, every day in my life was exactly the same. I was still just going to work. I was just having my friends. There was just nothing shifting. And I don't mean the lifestyle. It was much more just internally. I didn't know how to grasp it. And so after I started reading and studying these things when I was 18, I was very fortunate. And when I was 22, I was in this, what am I going to do with my life kind of state of mind. And then Swami Kriyananda walked into the room where I was. And I perceived in him the consciousness that I wanted to have. And as we go through this evening, I'll emphasize how important that is. I couldn't have articulated it, but I recognized it. And it was the grace of God, I say now, because he literally walked into the room. He had not spoken, and I just knew that he was what I was looking for. And now it's more than 40 years, and I've really never looked back. And it's been great, great fun, start to finish. And so through him, I very shortly moved up to Ananda Village, which was the first community being started by Ananda. He was just forming it in 1969. He had about, maybe, I don't know how much land they had then, 300 acres or something like that, handful of people. This was it was 1968, 69, 70. You know, we were all the hippies out there, milking the goats and growing organic food. But our world, we were doing all those things, but our emphasis was different. We didn't use drugs at all. And we were really there for serious spiritual reasons. Most of those communes and communities have evaporated, and Ananda has really sunk deep roots. That community is 40 years old now. We've raised 2 generations of kids there, so it's a really well-established world. The children who grew up there are raising their own kids there, some of them. So it's quite gratifying to see how it's taken hold. For me, what it's always been about, learning how to live. It's not been about dogma. It's not been about any particular religion or point of view. Yes, this is a path of discipleship. This is a path of gurus. This is a path of meditation. All of these things are part of it. But those are the supports and the means to the end. And the end is the purpose. And the end is, how do I feel when I wake up in the morning? How am I able to deal with the things that life gives me? Because just mere devotion to God, even serious sadhana, which is spiritual practice, does not spare you from your karma. You know, whatever is going to happen to you is going to happen to you anyway. People seem to think that, oh, I'll just become a devotee of God and then I get a free ride. No such luck. And in fact, the more serious we get about our lives in general, the more we get to engage on a deeper and more meaningful level. That doesn't mean that things get worse. That just means that our awareness expands and we get to, you know, do the job that we came here to do instead of just drifting through with in a kind of half-awake state and then suddenly finding ourselves in the astral world kind of hanging out there and then finding ourselves in a new body. What we're really looking for is deep and lasting change in engagement. Now, what I was starting to say before I stopped to give you my introduction, so everything I'm talking about tonight, everything I always talk about, is what I learned from Swami Kriyananda. I worked with him and lived close to him for many years, and since I've been in the Palo Alto area, which is now 25 years, I've lived in different communities from him, but always I keep in constant contact. So everything that I'm teaching is not my own invention. It's what Yogananda taught to Kriyananda, what Kriyananda taught to me. It's my own in the sense that after all these years, I can speak pretty solidly from my own experience about this, but I'm not making it up. Not everyone feels that source matters, but I know that it does. Because if you're offering a way of living life that is offered from the highest perspective, from the top of the mountain telling you how to come up the mountain, that's quite different than being halfway up the mountain and trying to guess where the trail that you're on is going to lead. So in this sense, this is a very completed teaching, even though I haven't completed it. But I know that those who are leading me have gone a lot farther than I've gone myself. So when I was saying earlier that I grew up as a reasonably harmonious person. I could always more or less get along with people. I was never comfortable in this world until I found Ananda and really found the meaning that I'd been looking for. But nonetheless, I functioned. And I found myself at the age of 19, and I was living, as it happened, in New York City. I'd gone there to talk to a friend, to tell a friend about the teachings of self-realization, actually. That's why my companion and I went all the way there. And I became aware of the fact, and this was the first time the word freedom really entered into my thinking. I became aware of the fact that living in New York City, especially if you're a California girl, you know, California's real mellow. New Yorkers are not, let's just say it that way. The whole East Coast is like a different planet to California people, but New York City is really especially so. People are very rough there, to my way of thinking, at least then. You know, just a lot more brash in the way they speak, a lot more pushy in the way they move through life. I think the world has amalgamated a lot since this happened, but this was a number of years ago. And I just couldn't get along in that atmosphere. And literally, the grocer was putting his thumb on the scale and, you know, weighing my vegetables heavier than they were. And I would see him do it and be too timid to do anything about it. And people would push me out of line and grab the things I was looking for. You know, just kind of the rough and tumble of life. And I realized that I was nice, not because I was really nice. I was nice because I was really afraid to actually engage with people who weren't nice. In other words, what looked like the right behavior. I mean, here I am reading about the spiritual path, and we're supposed to be loving, we're supposed to be unconditionally kind, we're supposed to be detached, and, you know, I could already talk a pretty good story. But in truth, when I projected out what that was supposed to look like, it was supposed to look like more or less like I thought I looked, which is kind of harmonious and nice. But I realized I wasn't really harmonious and nice. I was just a coward. And I realized that at the center of my behavior was not real understanding. At the center of my behavior was fear. And it was hard for me to think how anything that emanated from fear was ever actually going to take me where I wanted to go. And that was when it began to occur to me that the goal of the spiritual path is not to be nice. The goal of the spiritual path is to be completely free of all compulsion so that we can choose whatever behavior is appropriate for the time and place in which we find ourselves. Because for me to stand there and let the grocer put his thumb on the scale and charge me extra for plums I hadn't bought just because he was weighing it down with his own thumb was not appropriate. It wasn't appropriate for me to let him get away with it. It wasn't appropriate for me to pay the money. And, you know, it was kind of like his game. If he could get away with it, okay. And if somebody caught him, you know, then then he would get caught and they would all just laugh it off and nice try, Henry, but you know I'm not going to pay it. It wasn't like a big deal. And understanding that, I realized that I needed to get a lot more comfortable speaking my mind, standing up for my rights, demanding things that were that I should have, even though I didn't really care. Because it wasn't a question of how important the object was, it was a question of my being able to respond appropriately. And over the years of my life, many, many words have become key words for me, and one of those words is appropriate. Most of the time, we try to define our lives according to some picture that we've created of what we're supposed to be like. I'm supposed to be attractive in this way. I'm supposed to have this kind of money. I'm supposed to live like this. I'm supposed to dress like this. But we don't necessarily define our everyday moment-to-moment by, like, what is really appropriate here. And once we begin to get the word appropriate, but in order to behave appropriately, we also have to have the freedom to be able to choose our responses. So there I was in New York City, which was an excellent place to learn to speak your mind because nobody cared. You know, you could, for me, a California girl, I could just be unbearably pushy and nobody would even notice. So it was a really, and I was a stranger in the city. I had very few connections with anyone. And I set out over the course of that summer to learn to be a New Yorker. You know, just to be frank and strong and demand my rights and knock people out of line and grab the item away if I wanted to buy it and, you know, and just all that sort of thing and get the taxi cab and push the other person back. And I just started practicing. I mean, at first it was like so difficult just, you know, even to speak, to challenge someone, to talk to a stranger and, you know, tell him that he shouldn't be doing what he should be doing or whatever it was. But in the atmosphere there, you know, it was easier to do. And what became very interesting to me is by the end of the summer, I was looking for opportunities. Instead of being nervous anymore, I was looking for opportunities. And now I decided, again, that the center of my behavior, and this was in small ways, but the center of my behavior, I wasn't afraid of that anymore. Now I'd begun to enjoy being like that. And I decided that wasn't really appropriate. Interestingly, what I really needed to do was straighten out the relationship I was in. I was still totally motivated by fear in that relationship. So I could speak my mind to everyone else, but the one place I really needed to, it took me 5 more years before I was able to speak up there. But I began to practice. I began to notice what it is and what I'm doing. Now, when we're talking about freedom, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the ability to perceive from a higher level what the appropriate response is and then having access to whatever kind of energy is required of you in that moment. Years later, I had a very interesting experience with a friend of mine. By this time, I was living at Ananda Village, so it was maybe 6 or 7 years later, not that much later. And I was living at Ananda Village, and I and another group, as it happened, mostly women, but that was just a coincidence, were working on the publishing of Swami Kriyananda's autobiography. It's called The Path. It's now called The New Path. This was the summer of 77. And there was a group of about 8 women, and we had a printing deadline that we had to meet. Swami himself had finished writing the book and was in India at that time in seclusion, and we had responsibility for publishing this book, and I was pretty much the project manager on that and trying to make it happen. We were working day and night, and this was like just before computers. And you did the typesetting, and then you pasted the pages together, and you made photographic negatives, and to fix things, you used X-Acto knives and cut out words. I mean, it was really extremely primitive compared to what's done nowadays. So it was a big job, and every time we had to make changes, we had to proofread and so on. And our, you know, tensions were running high. And there was this one lovely Scorpio girl who was working there, who was a very dear friend of mine, still is a very dear friend of mine. She was very, very Scorpio. Scorpios, that's the insect that stings, you know? And whenever a Scorpio thinks that something's about to step on him, he bites. And Scorpios, because I have some very good Scorpio friends, I can say this, sometimes they take preemptive strikes, you know, just in case you might come over and step on them. They'll bite you first, just in case. But I got along real well. It wasn't an issue. But she was a strong-minded woman, and she did not have any inhibition about expressing her mind, ever. And we were in the building where we worked, actually had an open stairwell, and it was a 3-story building. And somehow or another, she got her dander up about something. And I don't know whether she was at the top or I was at the bottom. I don't know who was here, but we're three stories apart. And we're in the middle of the building, and everybody in the office can hear. And she starts winding up. And she's getting all hot about something or another. God knows what it was, who was proofreading what or something. And I sort of looked at her. I guess I was at the bottom, right, because I'm looking up at her. And I could see that she needed to fight with somebody. I mean, she just really needed to have strong words with someone. And I figured, well, why not me? You know, so she said something really loud, and I raised my voice to her and said something equally strong, and that gave her the capacity to shout a little louder, and then I answered her like this, and we sort of went together. I was never involved, you know, I was never mad at her. It was just like, this was the appropriate response. This is really what she needed. And we sort of argued to a crescendo, kind of resolved things down there, and then we began to come down, and, you know, the whole office is listening to this. This is in the middle of, you know, the yogic community where we don't do things like this. But she needed a fight. And as soon as she got it out of her system, we all just went back to work, and it was just fine. For me, it was also God's little joke, because I thought to myself, you wouldn't have been able to do that before, would you? You know, just the mere presence and thought of somebody sort of getting all hot under the collar would have just sent you running. And I was so grateful that my understanding of life had moved from being nice to being free. And from being free to be able to be helpful to people by responding appropriately, by having access to whatever it is that's needed. Now, does that make sense? Now, what keeps us from having that access, because we realize, and I also was really grateful because, let me just add one more point, because she was a good friend of mine, and fighting with me was completely no jeopardy. There was no jeopardy, no consequence, and so I spared all my friends, and I spared her. And also, it's like we're really on this planet to be of service to one another. In this book, it says, for those who inhabit this earth, we, as long as we inhabit, breathe the free air of this earth, we are obligated to render grateful service. That's how he puts it. Kriyananda puts it differently in something here, where he says we are bound together by bonds of mutual service on this planet. We really need each other. I mean, that's the experience that we all have. We really need each other. We don't just need each other for comfort and food and, you know, to procreate or anything like that. We need each other on a much more profound level. We need the interactions with each other that will be grist for the mill, that'll take the edges off, that'll be the river rocks rubbing against each other. You have to be a very advanced soul where you can, before you can live outside of close association with other human beings and still continue to make spiritual progress. You can hide, and you can sort of stall your expanding awareness by just simply refusing to engage. But otherwise, we really need each other. And the service that we're here to render one another is simply that, to help each other move toward greater and greater freedom. And greater freedom is based on expanding awareness and freedoms from compulsions. Now, we measure ourselves, you know, against a very real standard. And it's not the standard that everyone thinks of, but it's the only standard that matters. We have to measure ourselves against the perfected beings who have from time to time walked among us. And lacking direct contact with perfected beings, we have to measure ourselves against advanced souls or inspiring souls or exemplary souls, whoever comes within our sphere. But one of the most essential aspects of success in human life is to have some idea of where we're going, because we have a picture in our mind of what it looks like to get there. And the difficulty that I was facing when I was 19 years old is that the only picture I had in my mind of what, you know, what a good person was this sort of very vague and nebulous concept of being nice, you know, that had been inculcated from no particular wisdom, but just from the sort of, well, the herd mentality of being in public schools, you know, because if you're nice, everything goes more smoothly. Or if you're nice in your family, then you're not such a burden to the whole crowd, whatever it might be. But as I began to understand self-realization, I began to understand that there's an actual objective standard for human life. Swami Kriyananda has remarked several times that people often say, to err is human. That's a very common expression. To make errors is just human nature. He said, actually, to behave wrongly, it means that you're not yet fully human. Because to be fully human is to make maximum perfect use of the opportunity to be in a physical body. And the only ones who make maximum positive use of that are those who use this nervous system as it was really designed by God, which is to have the capacity to perceive infinity. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda was born free. He was born without any compelling karma. He didn't have any unresolved lessons to learn. He had understood the nature of life, the nature of infinity, and he lived in that reality. He incarnated into a human body. This is the descent of an avatar. The word avatar has been horribly abused as it's been taken up by the video game world, but the word avatar is really a very sacred word. It means the infinite spirit descending into human form. And through a being like Yogananda, whose life and consciousness you really understand from reading this book, and Kriyananda has actually just written a biography of Yogananda, which helps you even more, you really see the positive potential of human life. And as Yogananda describes in here, and he acts out the drama of being born and finding your way and finding your teacher and doing your sadhana and having your divine experiences. It's what's called a lila. It's a divine play. Because in truth, he already had that consciousness, but it would be no example for us if he were just born and then just sat there. You know, then people would say on our path, well, in your path, you have to meditate and do spiritual practices, but our guru just sits there and so do we. You know, he has to set the example, and the example he sets is one of tremendous determination to break out of this limiting reality, this illusion that we have that we are this small, egoic, separate, vulnerable, compelled being. And he describes how his spiritual efforts, you know, bring him to a perception of infinity that is the divine potential of all of us. But what advanced souls have is they have access to their full potential. And it's not that we have less potential, we just don't have access to it. And all of us in our lives understand that mysterious word, access. I write, I've written one book, I'm working on a second book. Friends of mine are writers. I have friends who paint or dance or sing. And, you know, anyone who works with the creative process recognizes what a interesting sort of dance it is to do creative work. Because, you know, writer's block or creative blocks, just trying to be able to get access. And then all of a sudden you have access and the energy will just flow. And you wake up in the night with ideas and you start working on something this way, and then another completely different idea comes to you, and you suddenly have access to all this reality. Sometimes if you're in a difficult personal relationship, you'll suddenly realize that you have access to a kind of forgiveness or a kind of patience that maybe you didn't have before or didn't know you had. Or people who are faced with great physical trials sometimes discover that in the hour of need, you have access to a kind of courage you just didn't know you had. I remember once I was in a litigation, and there was this extremely obnoxious lawyer, and he was pursuing me. I mean, literally, I was walking, and he was coming after me, and he was taunting me, and he was a terrible man. And I was so pleased. I just turned and faced him like that. Like, my first impulse was to run away from him, but then all of a sudden, I don't know where it came from. But I suddenly had access to this "you leave me alone" kind of energy that I felt so proud of myself afterwards. And it wasn't merely that I'd pushed him back, which was gratifying in itself because he was such a creep. But the other part of it was, look what came out of me. I didn't know I had that in me. You know, I didn't know that just like that it could come. And that's freedom. That's the kind of freedom we're talking about, to be able to behave appropriately and have access to whatever we need. Now, the human consciousness has this capacity to access infinity. That's why so much of the brain power that we have here, that, you know, ordinary medical doctors and psychiatrists, they don't know what it's for. They don't understand why we seem to be so inefficient. But the masters tell us that all that expanded capacity is because from the human form, we can actually access infinity. And that's what makes the human being the highest species. Because the nervous system in the human body has the capacity to be in the physical world and be in the infinite at the same time. The worm doesn't have it, the dog doesn't have it, the monkey doesn't have it. Just physiologically, they can't do it. Their systems are not refined. And in the marvelous process of reincarnation, you know, even through the animal levels and up to the human level, we manifest the form that gives us the capacity to express the maximum potential of our consciousness. So you don't go backwards. People always ask about reincarnation, well, does that mean I'll be a goat the next time? And then, you know, maybe I'll be a chicken, and then after that I'll be president of the United States. No, no, that's not how it works. What the whole process of expanding awareness to self-realization is about is exactly that, is gradually becoming more and more able to access the infinite consciousness, which is truly ours. And as you watch ascending species, you see that, for example, the worm or the little spider, he doesn't really have many options. You know, he can kind of scrunch this way, and then the worm can then scrunch this way, and he can chew on the dirt for a while, and then he can go over here and chew on this dirt. But, you know, he can't go to the library. And he can't learn songs. And he can't sort of reflect about the plight of worms in Brazil or anything like that. He just doesn't have access to that reality. And we manifest a form that allows us to have access and to express the edge of whoever and whatever we are. And as soon as we have used up the learning potential of that form, whether it's human or animal, then it goes away. And then we manifest another one that gives us another chance. That's why some are women, some are men, some are from India, some are from America, some are Latinos, you know, all these different things. Each of them has a certain context, and we get into that body, and then we start exploring the limits, of the expansive limits of what that body's going to give us. We'll have a body that has a fatal physiological flaw that'll cause it to develop maybe an illness at a certain point, a propensity, or we'll incarnate in a situation where we'll be exposed to radiation and then something will happen to us later, or we'll be exposed to an accident. And then all of those things define what we can learn through that form. Because that's the only reason we're here. We're not here to get money. We're not here to have a really good time. We're not here to have power over other people. We're not here just to be dull. We're here to have access to the infinity, which is our potential. And until we do that, we always feel a little bit confined. When I was growing up, I felt so, well, confined is the word. I felt so confined. And I couldn't really articulate it. It wasn't until I got into the path of self-realization and I got the concepts and the vocabulary. But I recognized those concepts and vocabulary immediately as the articulation of what I'd always known but not known how to say it. Because, you know, as I was saying, my upbringing was quite nice. I had a nice family. My parents are past now. You know, nice brother, nice sister. Comfortable, not wealthy, but comfortable. Good opportunities, education, everything you can mention. My parents respected me, so I had a lot of freedom. I could, you know, explore and do what I wanted. I felt so confined. I didn't even know the word, excuse me, but I just felt like I was just in this tiny box, and I had no idea how to get out of it, and nobody else seemed to mind, and people would just talk to me about just sort of you know, living in this little box for the rest of my life, except that I would get married and maybe I'd have children and have a little house and I don't know why it was like this, but my confinement used to peak in the image of those station wagons with the wooden sides. That was, if you're old enough, you remember those? Yeah, the Woodies, right. I used to have this terrible fear that I'd end up married and have one of those cars. And it represented to me imprisonment. Odd, isn't it? And I was a perfectly ordinary person. I wanted to get married. I always planned to have children, although I never did. But it was just like, is this all there is? And then finally, when I discovered self-realization and I had men and women of realization saying to me, of course not, you know, I realized that what was confining me was a very simple word, and it was my own ego. And the reason I felt so confined was because everywhere I went, there it was. I couldn't go anywhere without taking it with me. And it was so with me, I didn't even know that it was separate from me. You know, just the way it is. Little children don't even know their own bodies. A friend of mine with babies was talking about how her little baby keeps waking himself up because his own hands flash in front of his face and it scares him. Because there are these sudden lurking, moving beings that look so big to him, and he doesn't understand that it's his own body doing it. Because it's always there, and it just pops out of nowhere. He doesn't know how to get away from it. You know, it's just, how would he know? He doesn't know yet. You know, he hasn't figured out how to move it and how to keep it from scaring him and so on like that. Well, our ego, the way Yogananda describes it, is our infinite self. You know, our infinite self, identified, and this is a wonderful word. I have lots of words like appropriate, compulsion, identified with the body. And body in this is, mostly people think of physical body, but there's also an astral body, also a causal body. So we are infinite. That's where we come from. We are descended. We are manifestations of the spirit. Just like if you take the ocean and it has to go through a narrow channel, the ocean becomes narrow to go through that channel. But that even so, that narrowness, narrow thread of water extends all the way out to the ocean. When the ocean becomes lifted up in a wave, there's the appearance of this wave having this big thing happening, but in fact that wave is just a manifestation of the ocean. It was never anything separate, even though it appears to have the separate reality of its own. Now, we are the infinite ocean of spirit, but we have become identified with our bodies, since I'm using the word our, identified with our body. And identified does not mean that we have become it. It just means we have become defined by it. Now, I'm sure all of you have been through different experiences in your life, most of us do, in which we become deeply defined and identified with some particular aspect of our lives. I was speaking to a friend just a couple of days ago, you know, after 40 years of marriage or something like that, you know, she and her husband separated, and then he got a young girlfriend. And that just, you know, completely, even though she didn't want to be married to him anymore, she didn't want him to have a young girlfriend. That was like, you know, how confusing it gets. And so she had been identified with all of this reality. And now that identity, you know, it was all right if he just went to live by himself and was lonely, but now he was having a really good time. And that was extremely disturbing to her because she was so deeply identified with him, with, you know, having him belong to her, with him being a certain way, with her being a certain way. None of those things, I mean, I'm sitting there talking to her, like, none of those things are true now, you know? But you have been so identified with those realities that now that they've broken, you think you yourself are broken. When in fact, there's absolutely nothing wrong with you, but you've become so identified with that. you know, parents raise their children and their lives become totally focused on their children, and then the children leave, and then there's the empty nest. I loved reading this article about this woman just talking about how, you know, worried she was when her last child went to college, and she drove the child to college and cried all the way home, and then went in the house and said, "My God, there's nobody here but me." You know, just from that moment, she started having such a great time. You know, it had been in her mind that she had to identify herself with that role, and now it was over. But then she actually looked at the reality of it and just let go of that identification. It was a humorous article, but she was just totally happy because she had another identity now. So she had, nothing had been lost. Now, in the biggest sense, we have identified with our bodies, the physical body. I mean, people just take this so for granted. Somebody made the comment once, gender is the first thing you notice about other people and the last thing you forget. Because we just know people through their bodies. So, you know, I don't sort of think, David, was he a man? Was he a woman? You know, I just know he was a man. It's just very clear in my mind that he was. You know, I know Tigist is a female. It's very obvious. And I don't forget myself, you know, usually, whether I'm a man or a woman. It's the first thing we notice and the last thing we forget, right? I lived as a celibate nun for about a decade, and I did forget. I discovered you can forget. If you're not in an atmosphere that constantly reinforces it, it really can just go out of your mind. You just forget because it comes from other people's perception of you. Inside yourself, you don't know. But we have identified with the body, and therefore we have allowed ourselves to think in terms of age, nationality, ethnicity, gender, profession, relationships, all of these things. But we are, in fact, the infinite. And this body, even when the physical body dies, this body, the physical body, is a reflection of the astral body, which is the energy body, which is the one in the movies where when the body dies and the airborne one goes out and walks through walls and stuff like that. That's a depiction of the astral body. Some movies do a really actually pretty good job of it, because you're exactly yourself. You're recognizably yourself. You're not exactly like they are in the movies, but you're very similar. And you're not free. Death alone doesn't just dissolve you back into the ocean. You just go into essentially what is the blueprint for your physical body, the energy form that eventually comes out in a material body. Reincarnation, that's what reincarnation is about. You drop the physical frame, you go into the energy universe, you spend some time there, if it's your karma to do so, and then the energy pattern that is you manifests itself as another body. There's no break in your consciousness. A Buddhist, I heard, when somebody asked him about reincarnation, he said, nobody understands it because people think, I'm this, and then I'm this, and then I'm this. He said, there's no breaks. It's just one continuous experience. You're manifesting in this form, and then you're living in the astral world, and then you're manifesting in this form, and then you're living in the astral world. It never stops. We forget. But as soon as we come out of this body, we remember. And then we go into another one, and then we identify with it, and that's who we think we are. And all of our fears, all of our limitations, all of our compulsions, you know, everything, all of our confinement, is as long as the infinite self is identified with the body, we will feel confined. And we know that, if not consciously, we know that subconsciously. We know that somehow intuitively. And that's why there are more suicides among rich people than there are among poor people. Because when we don't have what we want of material goods in this world, of success, of circumstances, we think that if I can just get X, Y, or Z, then this feeling of limitation is going to go away. And so we work. And we work for incarnations, for this thing or that thing or the other thing. But very often, when we finally get it, then it's far more disturbing. Because now you're holding it in your hand. And you still feel confined. Because if you've just identified with another aspect of this material world, you haven't freed yourself from the essential problem. Now, the wonderful thing about this is because it's an identification, you can expand your identification step by step. It's not an all or nothing situation. Yogananda in his book describes the experience of cosmic consciousness, the total dissolution of everything of separateness, complete identification with the infinite. But he arrived at that place step by step, just like us. And so when we come to, you know, what we actually called this program this evening, that freedom is a practice, the practice is to gradually shift our identification from the limited sense of self that's created by identification with this physical and astral body, and then to begin to identify with the everlasting power that is the continuous stream that's going behind not only all the events of this life, but all the events of all the lives that we've lived. You know, when we use the pronoun I, what are we talking about? I remember myself as a child. I don't remember all of my childhood, but I have some very specific and very vivid memories. And, you know, that I, the context of that I was very, very different than the I that I talk about now. The I that I am, you know, this decade, by the grace of God, is very different than it was when I was in my 20s. You know, everything that I called myself then, it was such a swirling mass of such a different energy than who I am now. You know, so what are we even meaning when we identify even with this one body? You know, there's a unity, a unifying thread of consciousness. The more we live in that reality, the more we can relate not only to that reality, but the more effectively we can also relate to this one. Because what is it that causes us to be compelled and confused? It's because when we're so deeply involved and attached to something that we can't respond appropriately. Isn't that just exactly what it is? You know, I had a long, complicated situation I had to relate to through the number of years in our community. And, you know, I had a karmic knot with some of the people involved. And just whenever I'd get close to that particular relationship and situation, you know, I couldn't even tell what incarnation I was in a very real sense. You know, I couldn't tell what was really happening because I was so identified with feelings and thoughts and past experiences and so on that it was very hard to respond appropriately. I was always responding from some deep level of identification with this body or one of the others that I've lived in. And then you sort of step back a little bit, you identify more with the infinite self, you're no longer angry, you're no longer afraid, you're no longer anxious about what's going to happen, you no longer feel the need that you have to assert yourself, you're just able to stand in that spirit and say, how can I serve? You know, the inability to serve is always because of an over-identification with limitation. The ability to serve is always when we can see a reality that's greater than just the little tiny frame that we're in. So what I was starting to say a moment ago is that the good news about this is, this is how I wanted to put it, okay? Basically, if you think about infinity versus one inhabiting one particular body, you can see that what you're working with is, on one hand, infinity is a greatly expanded awareness. Okay, and compared to infinity, identification with one body is a very contracted awareness. So the really simple principle, the entire principle of spiritual life, no matter what path you follow, no matter whether you're dogmatic or free or whatever you describe it, is explained in these two points. I'll use the words expansive and contractive because it's easier that way. Okay? Depending on where you're standing, there's always something you can do that's expansive, and there's always something you can do that's contractive. And if you make the simple rule of your life that in every situation, make the most expansive choice you can make, it may not even be very expansive, but if I need to go to the right, if I just move that much, I'm going in the right direction. And if my goal is over there and I move this way, I'm moving away from my goal, right? Of course, if you can take a giant step towards your goal, that's nice. But it doesn't matter as long as you're just inching that direction, and even better as long as you're not inching away from it, right? We think that spiritual life and success in life is all about huge decisions. It's not actually. It's about every day, whether I choose a more expansive or more contractive. There's always a polarity. I'll give you an example. When I was early married to David, we're going to celebrate 30 years in January. So it's been a while. I was saying to him this morning, he's so cute. I said, does it seem long to you, 30 years? He said. So it doesn't seem long to me. It just seems like it's just today. He said. He was teasing me, of course. But when we were very first getting to know each other, we were actually on vacation in Hawaii with a group of people. And I think the issue had something to do with buying gifts for people back home. That's what I vaguely remember. And, you know, we didn't know each other well. And I'm a Cancer, and I sort of mull things over for a long time, and I have a very delicate sense of, you know, how things should be done. And he's Aries. He's just bold, and he's like, okay, let's just do this, you know. Okay, that's done. You know, let's check it off our list. I kind of want to vibe the whole thing. He wants to check it off his list. It took me about 10 years of the 30 to figure out that the only problem was that I was a Cancer and he was an Aries, and it really wasn't about anything else. But I think the issue had to do with buying presents for people, that I'd been trying to get him to pay attention to it, and he hadn't wanted to pay attention to it, and then when he finally brought it up, you know, he wanted to do it in such a way that I couldn't relate to. I mean, you know, the kinds of things that couples argue that are just completely stupid in retrospect. But it bent me out of shape. And it bent me out in a fairly major way. And it was happening in a group of people in a public place. And I got fairly intense about the issue, which I can do. Especially then, I could really do. And so there I am. And I want to just like whack him upside the head with my purse. That was like about how I felt, you know, just one of those kind of energies. I knew that wasn't a good idea. I was expansive enough in my thinking to know that that was not a good idea. I could have said something very rude, which I really wanted to do, but I also thought that maybe I don't want to do it right here in the store. And maybe I don't want to do it in front of all our friends. You know, that's going to just make the situation worse. So I was able to be expansive enough not to whack him with my purse. I was expansive enough not to create a big scene in front of other people in a public place. I was contractive enough that I knew that I was going to have to do something about this. This was not going to be a Christ-like forgiveness moment. You know, this was just not going to be a moment in which we say, oh, it's all fine, nothing ever really matters. Because it just mattered. There was nothing else I could do. So I sort of played this game that the most expansive option was to just say, what difference does it make? Just go along with what he wants and don't worry about it. The most contractive option was to just have a, you know, just a fit over something that was really quite trivial. And so I got as far as the sidewalk, and I still was just behaving in a pretty normal, nice way. And I kept trying the options. I decided I didn't even need to be upset on the sidewalk. I got us all the way back to the apartment. You know, the condo where we were staying. By which point, I was beginning to think more expansively and not only act that way. You know, he's a wonderful man. I love being married to him. We're on holiday, for heaven's sakes. You know, I could start a fight. And if I started a fight, it'll take, you know, the rest of the vacation to finish it. And so I thought, that's not really a very nice idea. And I thought, he doesn't mean ill by this. I started just reflecting. You know, it's just his way. He doesn't know how I feel about this. He didn't mean to do something wrong. I kept going expansive, and then I kept comparing it to the fact that I was still upset about it. But by the time I finally got us all the way back to the apartment and we're sitting down comfortably, I was able to say, not, why did you do that? I was able to say, you know, this is upsetting to me. And I was able to just put it on the table without throwing it at him. Now, if I had been less contractive, as I have gradually become over the course of our marriage, and I just don't take it so seriously when we have different opinions about things. But I was too contractive to be able to let it go, but I was expansive enough to choose a better way to do it. Now, When I was in New York, when I was 19 years old, to be nice was entirely contractive for me. The only expansive direction for me was to speak up and say what I felt, because contractive was my nice behavior was emanating from a place of total fear. So no matter what it looked like on the outside, what it really was this fear. And for me to expand beyond that fear, you know, to just stay in that fear was entirely contractive. So what we have to always be asking ourselves is not what is it on the outside, but what on the inside is causing me to do this. You know, and when I was sort of working through that silly argument with David, you know, I was solid inside myself. I wasn't afraid to talk to him about it. I wasn't afraid to make waves. I wasn't even afraid to spoil the vacation. I just didn't see any reason why I needed to. If, in fact, you know, it was a matter of life and death for me to assert myself, then the vacation would not have mattered, because it would have been necessary for me to simply stand up for myself if it was really important. But I valued the marriage more than I needed to speak up at that point, because I'd done this work 10 years before. You understand how that is? Now, in every situation in your life, ask yourself that question. And what is expansive? There are a few general rules. Generally, what is expansive is helpful to other people. Service, serving others instead of serving yourself, is generally more expansive than contractive. But it's contractive. Okay, let me say how to say this. You are just as important as everybody else. You're not more important, but you're not less important. Some people think that to be expansive means to never take anything for myself. But sometimes that's actually a very contractive attitude, because we're terrified to take anything for ourselves. And everybody else is valuable and has needs in God's eyes, but not me. But that's not an expansive thought. That's a completely distorted thought. You're not more important, but you're also important. If you really need something, you really need it. And to be expansive is to be courageous enough to say, well, you know, I'm kind of tired tonight too. I'm not sure I can do it. And then whoever you're talking to says, well, I'm kind of tired too. Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, who's the most tired here? Or how are we going to sort this out? Because everybody's needs are just out on the table. Okay, so what serves the greater good? What allows the people involved themselves to move in a more expansive direction? And that's why sometimes, you know, you don't want to do too much for your kids. Even though you think, oh, it's so expansive, I love my children, I'll do all these things for them, it's not always expansive to do too much for your children. Sometimes you're causing them to become contracted in their reliance upon you, and you're just doing it, what is really at the center here? Oh, I'm such a good mom, I do things that, you know, my mother never did for me, and, you know, that sort of thing. What's at the center here? Is it really a free action based on what's really right for everyone? You know, or is it just making yourself so contractive that you don't exist? You understand? Okay, and so what serves the greater good for everyone involved? And what, let's see, what was the other point that I had there? Oh, yes. Generally speaking, that which involves putting out more and more creative energy. In virtually every situation, more energy and more creative energy is more expansive. And again, it's just a matter of degree. Except when I'm doing classes like this and so on, I don't really usually like to do much work after about 8 o'clock at night. I don't know, I'm a morning person, except that I've learned to be an evening person. But in my regular life, mornings are when I have really good energy. I don't even like to wash the dishes at night. I just don't like to do any of that stuff. But sometimes it's like, okay, I'm not going to wash the dishes tonight, but at least I'll rinse and stack them. So instead of being the most contractive, which is just to leave the kitchen an absolute wreck, I'll rinse and stack the dishes, because that's a quarter of an inch more energy than I was willing to put out. So we can, this comes to what we're talking about. It's a deliberate and a conscious practice. Why am I resisting this? Because I don't feel like putting out energy. It's almost always about energy. quantity and quality of energy. That's why health and various other things come into play. But almost always what's more expansive is more creative energy. So if you think about, too, why we resist, why we contract, oh, it's because we're being asked to put out more energy and more creative energy, and we don't want to. But the most amazing thing, and I cannot emphasize this strongly enough, if you just get those two words in your mind, and every time you have to make a decision, don't think, I have to go to the infinite. See, that's what we do. We have to think, I have to be Christ-like forgiving and I don't feel that way. No, you don't. You just have to not create a scene in the middle of a public place. You know, that's enough. You can still be upset, but you just are a little more expansive than your worst. And you have a compulsion for eating chocolate candy and there's a box in your freezer. I mean, I joke about this, but you go, you get the box, you quickly take six pieces out of it and you put them down the garbage disposal and you turn on the garbage disposal and then you eat the rest of the box. Okay? Might have been more expansive not to get it out of the freezer at all, but at least you threw away six of the pieces before you ate it. And it becomes a game. But if in every situation in your life you try to put out a little more and a little more creative energy and you try to take the slightly more expansive direction, you will be astonished how much your life will change. Or even just if you stop and think for a moment, you know, what is the spectrum here? And how can I avoid the lowest? And how close to the top can I get? It becomes so simple, you don't need anything else in your life. You'll just be amazed. You know, I have 10 ugly things to say to this person. I'm only going to say 3 of them. You know, wow, I only said 3 ugly things. I'm just doing really terrific. Look how expansive I am compared to. Because we all think that we're going to get to the goal. We're just going to stand here and just have a, you know, please, Lord, come and get me. I'm going to do this, anything you want. And then somehow, whoa, we'll be over there. But it isn't true, actually. We get there like this. You know? And then we get bored, so we just go collapse over here again. But if you just keep walking. You know, I've been married 30 years. I've been on the spiritual path for more than 40. I didn't know when I started that I would be here now. I really didn't. And I just took a step at a time. And I took every step that looked sensible to me. And then, golly, you look back and decades have passed. And you hardly recognize yourself. But you didn't get there. You didn't get there by very big movement. You got there just by, you know. And every time you did something really horrible... Well, I won't say you. Every time I did something really horrible, then I had to deal between expansive and contractive and dealing with the horrible thing I just did. How guilty do I feel? How long am I going to torture myself? How long am I going to keep remembering this? When am I just going to move on? Identify with the infinite, not identify with the small. Does that make sense? Questions? Comments? Thoughts? Yes. I actually mean quite a lot by that. There's 3 levels of consciousness. We were talking about this earlier, about the position of the eyes. Earlier we were talking about the in the classroom with the where the lecture is like this. Teacher's down here. The people in the last row get worse grades than the people in the front row. And Rob was saying that it's partly because of the position of the eyes, because from the top you look down and from the bottom you look up. And I was saying that in yoga, the position of the eyes is related to your state of consciousness. When you fall asleep, and I mentioned also that as a public speaker, I sometimes get to watch people fall asleep, which is not something other people get to do. And I watch the eyes fall like that. And when we're thinking, we're straight on like that. And when we're inspired, our eyes always go up because the energy goes to here. That's why pictures of the spiritual eye, that's why pictures of saints are often with their eyes rolled back, because literally that is what happens. And sometimes people, when they die, their eyes go up. They go here. Okay, those are the 3 states of consciousness. Subconscious, which we recognize as sleep, the conscious mind, which is us just here now, the superconscious, when we're reaching from where we are into the infinite. Now, in truth, there's actually just the 2 states of consciousness. Subconscious is not just what it's meant by psychology. Subconscious is everything that you've already done. It's the memory in a computer. It can't do anything that it hasn't already done. I'm not a computer programmer and I'm not that adept at it. It's taken me a long time to realize that when the computer misbehaves, somewhere there was a wrong command given to it. I think it's a conscious being that is torturing me. But I have become persuaded that it is not. It's just programmed to behave in a certain way, and if you violate its little rules, it will torture you. It's not personal. Okay? The subconscious, in this sense, is exactly that. It's everything that you've done before that's, you know, that's a strong force of this is who you've always been and this is who you must remain. And it's not merely your subconscious, in the psychological sense, remembrances of this life. It's the impressions in your chakras, the vrittis, the samskars. Those are words that mean those things that happened in previous incarnations that are also pushing on you, that cause you to always think that this woman is going to mistreat you or this man is going to be wonderful or these different things because you're programmed to feel that. The superconscious is where the ego begins to dissolve and we begin to remember our infinite self. And the force of that reawakening is really tremendous. It's called smriti. Smriti means divine memory, to remember. And you know those old-fashioned diving bells that would be in like science fiction movies and so on like that, and or submarines, and you have this tremendous pressure of the ocean, and the submarine has to be so strong to sort of keep the ocean at bay. Well, our egos work so hard to keep the superconscious from coming in because it's always trying to break through. But we just cling to our limited definition and so we don't notice except once in a while. The conscious mind is simply the battleground where those two forces meet, where the force of the past and everything we've always been sort of pushes on us to stay exactly where we are and don't rock the boat and don't think you can be any different and just go with just the easiest route, put out as little energy as possible and just follow your habit, just stay the way you are. And the superconscious is saying, just break out of all of it and just come into something completely new. True creative work comes out of the superconscious. That's where intuition and divine attunement and meditation and prayer and all of that awakens that, and that's where, you know, the real original reality comes from. That's original because it's closer to your point of origin, which is the superconscious. So creative means inspired by the superconscious because by definition you cannot be creative from the subconscious because it's already there. I mean, people do, in fact, it's interesting, you get sort of accustomed, you see people's art and you can tell whether it's subconscious or superconscious creativity because the subconscious can reorganize. But the nature of the subconscious is it's all related to everything that's happened before and it's all defined by me because it's my personal little memory bank. And the superconscious is where the individuals all begin to merge. It's because we're, instead of being a wave, we think of the high wave as being the really great, great one, but in fact, it's the ones that are the closest to the ocean because that's where the real power is. So speaking of art, for example, people whose art is has great personal meaning for them, it often has very little universal meaning. And the art that endures is the art that's inspired through the individual, but it's related to the whole. And that's what comes down from superconsciousness. That's why when John Lennon was asked once of the Beatles, do you think the music of the Beatles will endure? He said, why should it? Which was a perfect answer. I mean, some of it is good, but much of it is creative, charming, delightful, but it's not infinite. It's just fun. You know, it's taking what we already know and just putting it together in a new way. You know, some of it was a little bit more than that. But he was honest enough to say, you know, I'm not acting like Beethoven or Mozart. I'm just John Lennon, and I'm just having a good time. No, he was creative. I'm shifting a little because he was creative, but his creativity was more subconscious. But what expansive creative energy is to look at this and to think not just what is my habit, but what can I do? How can I use this to move in a to? By definition, you see, as you expand your awareness, you're going into territory you haven't been in before. So the idea of creativity, and I use the word original, and I'll throw it back in. To be original is to move from your point of origin. And I mean divine origin, not just origin meaning your past, but to really act from where you came from. And truly original work is always inspiring. Even if there's nothing in it that you can look at that has never been done before, you can still feel that it's a genuine expansive experience from the individual who moved into a newer, higher state of awareness for them when they created it. Does that make sense? It's very important. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
I have a question about reincarnation.
Okay.
So, we're here to learn, to grow, to learn.
Right.
But when we are spirits, like what you said, divine being, before, not on the earth, we already know the love and everything. Why do we have to come to earth and again and again?
Well, you have to understand that the part of us that is knowledgeable is not yet individualized. Okay, and once we become individualized, which happens early, we have a certain amount of free will and we begin to have choices. And we're not able to access at the beginning the full understanding of who we really are. And we have this outward moving energy that causes us to want to have experiences and test the waters for ourselves. Partly the question you're asking is, why did God make it happen the way he made it happen? Vivekananda said, the level of consciousness that asks the question cannot comprehend the answer. Because we ask the question, we say, I'm sitting in here and I want to have the view from the Empire State Building. And why am I not on the top of the Empire State Building? Well, honey, because you're not. You've got to walk to the top of the Empire State Building, and then you'll have the view from the Empire State Building. No, I want to have that view now. But you can't, because you're not there. So the other question is, how happy am I, and what can I do to make myself happier?
But when it will be complete, when would you complete? How do you graduate?
Because you're... Okay, if you think of progress in your life, progress is always a cycle, an avenue of ever-increasing awareness. I mean, even from just being a child, you learn to read. If you live in one culture and you move to another culture, if you know one language and you learn a second language, if you're going to raise a child and you learn how to be a parent, if you want to be a petroleum engineer and you get your degree, what's happening is you realize you're becoming aware of more and more and more. And when we think about anything in our lives, whether it's an external accomplishment, an internal relationship, a self-understanding, if you really think about it, it's always because it's a process of increasing awareness. And sometimes when we get ourselves in a lot of trouble, it's because we weren't aware of something we should have been aware of. I wasn't aware that my boss is an egomaniac. I wasn't aware that the man I married is an alcoholic. I wasn't aware that my child is on the autistic spectrum. And then we become aware, and then things move forward from that. Okay? So the question simply is, you can look at the course of 1 year, 1 week, 1 day, and see that greater awareness brings sometimes greater responsibility, but it also, in the end, brings greater happiness. You know, just to pretend that my husband is not an alcoholic and everything is fine doesn't really work. To pretend that my child is not autistic doesn't really work. Somewhere, you have to understand, become aware, and begin to act. So then you ask yourself the simple question, where's the end of that? Where is the end of that? Well, you just keep moving until you find out. Yogananda's answer is that he said, you go on until you achieve. Evolution ends when you achieve endlessness. That's infinity. And you have to take the word of the great ones on this. You know, the great masters all agree with each other. The scriptures all agree with each other. They say, be therefore perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. They tell you that this is your destiny. And you have to, at a certain point, the present misery is so intense that you don't really have to know the end point to begin to walk toward it. And until the present misery is so intense, you worry about the end point. But when the present misery is so intense, you just start walking toward it, because anything is better than standing here. Yes?
The question on the creativity, and uh-huh. You had mentioned that we're bound by the ego and what we see.
Right.
Our ego in uh-huh. the art that we might create, mm-hmm. and that you see the true creativity in the super consciousness once in a while. But is that not something that would be a common understanding in the astral plane? I mean, if we were in that, would that true creativity be just a common understanding?
You don't, merely dying does not make you a whole lot better than you already are. It just makes you just what you are, but without your physical body. And there's many astral planes. You know, that's the common stories of heaven and hell. But a physical planet like planet Earth, at this time in planet Earth's evolution, it's a heterogeneous vibrations here. You know, you have some very advanced souls, you have many very refined souls, you have some really, really dark, terrible souls. And so, you can just walk down the street and you know a demon can walk, you know, a really dark person can walk by, or a saintly person can walk by. I mean, we can just be all with each other all the time. The physical body dulls down a little bit the vibrational forces so that heterogeneous vibrations can be closer to each other. In the astral world, when you take off the physical body, the dullness created by the weight of matter is removed, and we are purely our vibrations. And the astral worlds are homogeneous vibrations. That if you're really, really dark, you simply cannot get into a higher world. So when you die, you're more intensely what you are, but you are not suddenly a million times more than you are. And if you're a good person and a spiritually minded person, you go to a very nice place. If you're a really horrible person, you go to hell. That's where hell comes from, but not hell the way people think. But you're just suddenly in a homogeneous world where there's nothing but those vibrations, and you feel them very intensely. And you suffer. If you suffer enough, you reform a little bit. I don't exactly know how exactly you learn in the astral world and how it happens. But you hang out in those vibrations for a while until you take another physical body, till the force of your karma draws you back in. Did that answer your question? Yeah. These are things I understand from a certain amount of intuition and a certain amount of just what I understand the teaching to be. So I'm somewhere in between. I can't go to the astral world. I don't see the astral world. But I remember it. Somehow I have a knowingness about what that world is like. And, you know, if you're a lovely person and a sweet, kind person, the astral world's very beautiful. It's very interesting. I'll give you an example. We have a community. Ananda has a community, which is right at the border of Mountain View and Palo Alto. And it's an apartment complex that friends of ours purchased for the sake of leasing it to us. Ananda doesn't own it. But when we took it, which was now in 1989, it was really run down. It was a tear down. And it was a 5 acres of land. It's still the largest intact parcel. Everything else has been built up and torn down. We managed to keep living in these old buildings. But it was a very transitory population. The police were called 3 or 4 times a week. It was a mess. And when we moved into it and, you know, we're starting to clean up and, you know, moving some of the existing tenants on their way so that we could move in and renovate, so many of those people, brown rugs, brown furniture, black things in their room, dark curtains. And the apartments were not bright anyway, and they'd sit in their apartments with their dark curtains closed and their dark carpets and their dark furniture. You know, it was just like, but, and then we'd come in, we'd open the curtains, we'd rip out the black rug, we'd throw away the brown furniture, you know, everything, and we'd open it and put flowers out there. It's like, that's our astral universe. We're recreating on this planet what we remember. Light, beautiful colors, lots of sunlight, lots of harmonious shapes, And those people were creating the astral world that they remember, which is heavier and darker and just more, you know, like this kind of energy. That's why I'm going to look at Tigas, who always wears black. That's why I say to people, wear this color, this beautiful magenta color this lady is wearing. You know, create the world that we really want for ourselves. That's what makes the astral world beautiful. You know, why create these dark, confined worlds? It's very useful to open your closet, look at your living room, what's on your walls? You know, what are the colors in your house? What do you look at when you wake up in the morning? What do you surround yourself with? What's your music? What's your wardrobe? What's your face? I mean, what are you doing? What are you making out of this world? Is it contractive? Is it expansive? You know, where are you going with yourself? And these are just small steps, you know, just wear nicer colors, or at least have nicer colors in your house. Keep your windows open. And just all these little things. That's how it happens. It's just that we train ourselves little by little. Does that make sense? Swami, I've always liked color, but I used to be very careless about my appearance. Swami finally just said, Asha, we have to look at you. You know, it's not a matter of vanity. It's just a matter of being kind to your friends. You know, don't be an eyesore. And, you know, I was just an eyesore. As he's fond of, Swami's fond of teasing me, you should have seen her before David got a hold of her. That's how he puts it. You know, my husband has superb taste. My girlfriend's always, he would take them shopping. I mean, so these are, you know, years ago, but I mean, there was a wonderful color consultant. My friends would all go to this color consultant, and David would take them shopping. He could go into any store. He just has an eye. He just finds the best things in the store. Sort of wasted on me. But, because I just never had the will to follow it. But where was all of that? Oh, that was just like, what are we creating? What are we making in this world? Which astral universe are we living in? It's fascinating. So you look at others and you can see, and you can also look at yourself. You know, if somebody came into my house, who lives here? How would they read? It's great fun. Just go back into your own home and look at it. If a total stranger came in and tried to figure out who lived here, how would they describe that person? And is that really who I want to be? All right, any other questions? Yes.
I was wondering about the orange color. What kind of place is that?
What is the orange color?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's in the sunset. It's the color of fire. It's the traditional color of renunciation. The traditional Swami order is dressed in orange. Our renunciate order is dressed in blue. We shifted from orange to blue. So I wear this color. This is an initiation color, and I always wear it. Orange is a more self-assertive color. It's obviously a happy color, but it imposes itself upon you. You know,
the
highway workers wear it because you can't miss them, right?
Yeah, I just feel like it's pretty wrong to me, like, even from...
You like it or you don't?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, color is a mystery. Well, there's colors in our auras. I mean, I can't see them, but I know they're there. I recently had my picture taken. You know, you have colors in your auras, so you're relating to those. But color is a vibration. And it's very, very interesting color. I wear blue all the time now. I've worn it for a little over 2 years. I thought I couldn't stand it. I was very into color. And had a whole closet full of beautiful colors, and every morning it would be like, what color do I feel like wearing? And if I was in the wrong color, I'd have to change my clothes. Every time I'd go to a public place, a public program, I'd stop and think, you know, what color is this program going to be? And then I took this initiation, I just had to go just to blue. I thought it would be terrible. It was really hard for me. But as soon as I did it, I don't know, I can't imagine. I just can't imagine being in another color. I had to borrow a jacket once, and it was peach. I finally just decided I'd rather be cold. Because I've just, whatever this vibration is, I've gotten so in tune with it, it's just, I can't wear anything else right now. So I play with these things. I've always played with them. I love it.
But they also say color has psychological...
Definitely, definitely.
And vibrations. Orange is one of the colors which travels the fastest.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Yeah, exactly. It's fire and it's beautiful.
I love orange.
Yeah. I used to wear it too. Okay. Anything else? Yes, take us.
I would like to say, lady, mean whole life.
Say again?
Mean party who wear black most of the
time. Uh-huh, I know. These are good friends of mine. We're teasing each other here.
I would like to say there's a lady who made a lifetime with her black and white Chanel.
Oh, okay. I respect it. I love you anyway. You have lovely smiles. You compensate for it. I joke about it because, you see, I'm a public speaker. And when the whole audience comes in black, it's so boring for me. You have no thought of me. You should think of me, not of yourself. This lady's magenta is such a joy to look at. And all of you are fine. I'm just teasing you. Yes.
I wanted to add that, you know, speaking of infinity, space is infinite. And when we look up from our perception, it's dark and black.
Right, exactly.
So it's like beautiful in that way. And then there's the Shiva Lingam in our culture, and usually they're black. The natural ones are brown.
Gray. It's true.
But they're black. So in a way, I think sometimes people will wear black to be feeling protected, protective, or to just kind of have their, you know, like this is a day of internal processing.
Well, I accept that. And I know it's practical, and I understand all that. So I'm just teasing. This is a small joke, me and color, and the colors the people wear who come into my rooms. There were those years when everyone wore black. I mean, I'd look at our whole congregation on Sunday morning. You know, we're singing Joya, 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 and they're all just black, every one of them. Fortunately, that fashion passed.
Well, actually, my house is full of color.
Good girl. Well, look at you. You're wearing
red.
You're forgiven. You don't have to defend yourself. It's fine.
I have just one note about color. I work as a baggage handler, loading luggage on airplanes. So I'm like a luggage connoisseur. Women and men are so different. Men, it's dark, it's black. They're afraid, I think, to, I don't know. But women, whenever I see flowers, polka dots, anything, colors.
It's all about the girl.
Women.
Yeah.
And that's so representative. I don't know.
Well, it is true. There's truth in that. Yes, dear. Certainly. If any of you have to go, it's okay. You know, but let's go ahead.
What's that program called Journey Back and Beyond? It's talking about people who temporarily left the body and they come back.
Have death experience, death and return experiences.
Right.
Okay.
So usually in the program, those people would say, you know, this life, do what matters.
Right.
Personal life, you know, I'm having my own business and have to kind of drive getting things done. And there are times I just don't have that balance. So how do you remain, you know, passionate or compassionate to things, to people?
You have to work.
Because those are what matters.
You have to make really hard choices. Mm-hmm. And you have to not... The way Swamiji put it to me once is sometimes you have to put a rock into the river. You can't always just go with the current, you know. And it's not easy. It's just as simple as that. And flowing with the current is easier than being a self-declared person. It's easier to just let things happen to you than to really decide what you're going to do. If you really want to know, I mean, here's Ananda. You know, this is not like we're here for 1 hour or 2 hours tonight. But what I'm talking about is a lifetime of discipline. But the wonderful thing about, and I'm holding this up because this is our place, is that even, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, even a little bit of the practice of this inward religion will save you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. This is not I'm good and then I get to go to heaven, or I'm bad and I go to hell. This is like, I feel terrible today, but if I shift my attitude just a little, I'm going to feel better. And if I'm a little confused and I start meditating just a little bit and just really am able to hold my center, I'm going to feel a lot better. So it's not like I do this and then someday. It's like, oh, look, if I just, instead of getting upset, if I just breathe deeply, if I stop and step back from this problem and I pray and I try to tune into a superconscious solution, it's better. It's better right there. And just look, you know, I averted a catastrophe because a little bit of the practice of this inward understanding will save you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. It's a divine promise, but it's also a fact. That's why it's not really a question of all of this. It's a question of, gosh, what could I do right this minute? I've given you a few suggestions. This is our, about us, and this is the programs. I mean, and come to East West every night of the week. You know, there's lots of places, but you have to do something. If you just sit there and hope it'll happen, you'll die just as you were born. You know, it just it takes effort. That's one of the reasons why people don't do anything about it, because you have to use your willpower. But gosh, the alternative, oh my word, the alternative is so freaky. You know, that's what I lived with until I met Kriyananda. Like, oh my God, I'm going to just end up with one of those station wagons. Just like, I can't.
In the Midwest, those station wagons were considered cool.
Oh, well, I know. That was, but that was what it was, is that like, if I end up there, you know, I just had this feeling like this can't be all there is. There has to be a thread through this. And I mean, I've lived, you know, now I'm, you know, always dressed in blue and I do all these other things, but really I've just lived a life a lot like your lives. I've lived it in the context of Ananda, but, you know, I've had a marriage, I have lots of friends, I travel, I, you know, I do creative things, and, you know, I have a good time. But there's a thread. And that thread is, this is never a means to an, this is never an end in itself, this is just a means to an end. Everything that I'm doing is about expanding my awareness to become more of who I was meant to be, and because the more I am who I'm meant to be, the happier I feel. That's real, real direct. It's just, I used to feel a lot worse than I feel now. I feel a huge amount different than I did. I mean, you know, most people's lives, they wind down. You know, instead, I watch mine as going the other way. Because starting when I was 18, I just started doing it. You know, and it's not been easy. And there have been lots of times when I've just lain down on the ground and thought, mm-mm. But then it's miserable. Somebody said to me, it's just not that easy to lie down and die. You get bored, you get hungry. So every so often you quit, but where does it take you? Nobody does anything except for happiness and to avoid suffering. So when you suffer enough, you change. And when your actions bring you what you want, you repeat them. But people prefer the known misery to the unknown promise. So there's always that edge. That's the subconscious and the superconscious and the battleground. The battle of Kurukshetra, literally. The Bhagavad Gita. Great souls, okay.
I wanted to thank you for the deep place you took us today. I really appreciate
it. It's very kind of you.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to mention, it's almost like when you talked about Yogananda and the avatar, it's like, you know, getting plucked up mm-hmm. in space and then having the journey and viewing
yes.
and observing, kind of like the witness, the entire play.
Mm-hmm.
My question, I have a small question, which is that why at times we get forgetful, we reach that, and then is that part of just the play, or it's just in the journey, or
it's because we're not
in our nature properly.
No, it's because we think of ourselves, if we think of ourselves in terms of athletics, we think of ourselves as a single long distance runner who, once he reaches a certain point, he's there. We are in fact an entire sports team. Okay? And so every so often, one of our guys gets the ball and he streaks across and returns the punt, right? And then we think, that's it! But we didn't really realize that all these other guys, you know, and there's some on the injured list, and there's folks in the locker room, and this guy's high on drugs, and, you know, it's just a mess. So, but that guy did return the punt. But once he's done, somebody else gets the ball for a while. And you know, gradually the whole team comes up and we win the Super Bowl, or however you want to say it. But that's the confusion, is that when we get one little tiny piece of ourselves out there, we think we're done. But in fact, we have to get the whole team going. All right. Okay.
There's lots of us.
Yeah. Within
yeah.
us, yeah. Yeah, they're our mental citizens, is how Swami calls it.
Our nature, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I would like to release you.
Yeah.
And if anyone has any other questions, I'm not in a hurry to go, but I've held you here long enough. So thank you very much for coming. Okay.